Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The coronavirus, specifically the nCoV-2019 virus, has broken out of China and has begun to spread around the world. Although the number is climbing rapidly, at last report, I think 170 people in China have died. More than 7,700 people have been infected, and many people are spreading it. Who are spreading it exhibit no symptoms. They don't know they're sick. This is another in what it seems like an ongoing string of new diseases for which we have no protection, like other diseases that have spread quickly. This has gotten the media's attention, and when that happens, the disease becomes viral in another way. The news of it spreads like a contagion, and many wonder, even those of us in the media wonder, just how serious this might be. Are we blowing this out of proportion? Especially when you have the National Academy of Medicine predicting future pandemics could kill millions and cost trillions and opining that it's only a matter of time. So the question becomes, are we ready for a plague? We take a closer look at that important question and at just what this virus is, where it came from, why it is suddenly spreading to humans, and more. Dr. Katie Pazzarotti is Medical Director of Infection Prevention at Atrium Health. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Good morning. She joins us in our Spirit Square studio along with Dr. Daniel Janis, the Carol Grotnus Belk Distinguished Professor of Bioinformatics and Genomics at UNC Charlotte. Welcome back to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and you can also watch us on Facebook Live. So before we start talking about whether or not we're ready for a pandemic, let's talk about this virus. The virus was provisionally tagged as the And I don't know what the capital letters mean. It's small N, capital O, the nCoV-2019, which is short for novel coronavirus of 2019. That would mean there have been other coronaviruses. Where were they, and how were they different, Dr. Janis?
Well, the human important ones are some that are just involved with the common cold. Okay, so something like 30% of common colds are caused by coronaviruses. The spectacular ones are SARS from 02-03, MERS from about 2012, and then now Wuhan coronavirus, or novel coronavirus 2019, which is actually very closely related to SARS.
So I'm told there are a multitude of cold viruses, and if you get one, you can't get it again. You won't be impacted by, if that's true, you won't get it again. You'll get a different
virus. Not near term, but okay. You know, they mutate very rapidly, and you'll get another strain.
So if you've been exposed to these other coronaviruses, are you likely to be susceptible to this one?
Yes.
Okay. What makes this one novel? Because it's called novel coronavirus of 2019.
Well, it's not actually novel, because okay. We can trace its lineage back to bats. What's novel about it is it's in people, and it's making the news. It's novel. The zoonotic event, the change from bats to people, is novel. What's very interesting about it is civets were implicated in SARS.
Those are cats?
Yeah, little weasel-like carnivores. But actually, we were able to show in 2008 that SARS emerged from bats, infected humans first, and then infected civets, and then went back into humans.
How does the disease emerge from bats and then infect humans? They have to be bitten by a bat or scratched by a bat?
That's a good question. Yeah, I think could be. We don't know yet. That's a research question. Could be bat guano, aerosolized. The problem with the SARS story is we could see that evolutionary pattern, but the bat-hosted viruses in 2002 and a little bit earlier didn't have the right proteins on them to interact with human receptors. So there's something missing in that story. However, what's really fascinating about Wuhan coronavirus is the bats that were hosted viruses that are discovered as recently as 2013 have the right proteins that can infect human cells. So this is directly out of bats.
So this is right in your ballpark. This is what you do every day. You study these things and the genetic components of these things. When did you first become aware of this virus? When it hit the newspapers and the radio and television?
Yeah. I started to hear in mid-December about a idiopathic pneumonia in China. And that's exactly what happened with SARS. We thought it was bacterial pneumonia. until we sequence it, until we can see what it actually is. So, and then the sequence hit, and we knew what it was.
So when I, in my layman's position here, when I think of what you do, I think of you hunched over a microscope all day with little slides and Petri dishes or Petri dishes. But you do a lot of your work, or maybe most of your work, on a computer, right?
Yeah, we do some in the wet lab, but and somebody in the world is isolating the virus, right, and crushing it, getting out its RNA, converting it to DNA, sequencing it. But now that information is rapidly shared over the internet, so we don't have to do that ourselves in this case.
So other coronaviruses seem to have been first transferred to humans in marketplaces, food marketplaces, and at agricultural sites in China. This was first recognized, I think, in what some call a wet market, which we'll talk about right now. That's a seafood and live animal market. This one happened to be in Wuhan, where they sell, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, exotic animals for human consumption. Is that correct?
That's correct. Everything under the sun.
What would be an exotic animal that they sell for human consumption?
Turtles, snakes, small carnivores, all kinds of fowl.
Like raccoons and things like that. Does this practice have to end in China if we are ever to stop, if they are ever to be stopped being the epicenter of these outbreaks of disease? They seem to be, they in Africa, seem to be the places where all these diseases emerge.
Yeah. There's clearly, you know, a crisis machine that ramps up. The markets are closed. Happened with avian influenza. Happened with SARS. Happening again with Wuhan coronavirus. But then they open again, and I don't know why. And there's underground trade as well.
Well, these markets have been going on for millennia.
Perhaps so.
So why now? Or was it just always confined? We didn't know about it because the news didn't travel, and it didn't, and the disease didn't travel because there were no airplanes.
Well, perhaps people got sick for millennia too, and we just didn't have, you know, molecular sequencing to see it so well and diagnose it exquisitely.
Yeah. We don't know where this virus originated, do we? This particular
originated in bats in China.
Okay, bats in China. As did what you say. MERS?
MERS has a bat's ancestry as well, but MERS seems to have been reservoired in camels in Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
SARS has a bat's ancestry, then humans, then civets, then humans again.
So bats seem to be carriers of lots of viruses, it seems to me. But do bats get sick from these viruses, or are they just carriers?
No, I think they're just carriers, yeah.
How can that be? Are we carriers of viruses that we don't get sick from?
We probably have millions of different variants of viruses in us. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. What's special about bats where all these diseases seem to be emerging? What's the common denominator, I guess?
I think it's a good question about why it's not pathogenic in bats, and maybe it is slightly, but the virus is got a job to do. It's got to get around, right? So, and it's got to replicate itself. And that's what's so interesting about Wuhan coronavirus. It's much like, I was talking with the doctor here, much like H1N1, is that it keeps the human host ambulatory and walking around, and that's what makes it so successful. It's not, we don't know, it's not particularly deadly yet, and that fact that bats and people are moving around really presages the pandemic.
I mean, we're doing this program because the World Health Organization and other people who, you know, try to keep us well, have said this is serious, and we've got to get a handle on it, and we've got to get a handle on it now. And this seems to be one of a series of these disease outbreaks that we've experienced in the world in the last 25 or 30 years. And as you say, maybe we experienced them before. Maybe they didn't travel as quickly because air travel wasn't as predominant. Maybe it was localized and unrecognized because the medical profession had not been able to identify it. We certainly didn't have the kind of tools you have, and we didn't understand genomics, and we didn't understand DNA sequencing, so maybe we didn't know. But when these things emerge, they always seem to be new. Are they new, or are they just things that have been lurking in the shadows for years and we didn't know about them?
They're only a few mutations away from the bats, and we only see snapshots. So there could be a whole continuum of variants out there.
That was my next question.
Yeah, sorry.
That's okay.
And so, when we see the epidemic, we sequence the same virus over and over, and everybody's got the sequencers running. When the crisis ends, we're not sampling all the time. And so they're out there, but we're just not we're not paying attention.
And when the virus changes enough that it can spread from person to person, that's when we, so viruses in animals sometimes stay in animals. There have been coronaviruses in cows, other types of animals. But as he was saying, when the virus mutates, it obtains the ability to transmit effectively from person to person. And when a virus that we're completely, we've never been exposed to before, gets into the population, no one has pre-existing immunity, and that's why we really have the concern. There's a lot of potential of spread.
How often do these viruses mutate? Do they all mutate over time?
All viruses mutate. Influenza mutates constantly. That's why we have to get the flu shot every year. Viruses are constantly trying to figure out how to survive, just like everyone else.
Do we understand? Is that what it is? It's just survival? We've humanized these things. They're trying to figure out how to survive. Are they trying to figure out, or is it just
a
fact of
life?
Random.
Yeah,
this is what they do.
Yeah, yeah. They make many different. They're wonderfully sloppy in how they replicate themselves. Make many different variants. Many go extinct, and some don't. And
because,
those are the ones we notice.
Because when they infect the host, one would, if you're going to humanize, anthropomorphize these things, one would think that their goal is to infect you in such a way that they can thrive in you, but you don't die. Because with you, if you die, they die with you. So they're certainly not thinking.
Yeah, that's a very optimal virus for moving itself around the planet. Yeah.
And okay. That's why this one's particularly concerning, because the symptoms aren't particularly severe, right? If you have very severe symptoms, you seek medical attention, or you die quickly, mm-hmm. you don't have the potential to spread to as many people. So smart viruses do tend to have fewer symptoms initially, but high potential for spread.
So once you're exposed, because you mentioned the possibility of not being able to be reinfected by this virus. If you get this and you survive it and you meet somebody who has it, you're not going to get it again. Is that right?
This particular one,
unless
it doesn't protect you from all the other coronaviruses or other viruses down the road.
How long? What is our only line of defense? What is our line of defense against these things? What do medical professionals, what tools do you have?
So I think we try to advise people to identify, isolate. So the big things that you can do in the public are staying home when you're sick, you know, trying to stay away from people that are visibly coughing and phlegming everywhere. And then hand hygiene probably is the most important thing that we keep hammering on time and time again. Wash your hands, wash your hands, wash your
hands. And don't touch your face.
And don't touch your face or your eyes everywhere.
So, but aside from that, If I've done all that or I haven't done all that and I get this thing and I come to you because I'm exhibiting, I don't feel well, I don't know what it is yet, but you recognize what it is, what can you do for me?
So unfortunately, right now, there's no treatments for this particular virus. They're looking into whether some antiviral agents may be effective. But right now, it's really supportive care. It's controlling the symptoms. It's supporting your breathing. If you have a more severe case of the infection, many, many people have mild disease and like the common cold and resolve on their own. But unfortunately, we don't have a treatment right now.
Do antivirals do anything at all? The things that you buy at the drugstore, you think you have the flu, they don't do anything.
I mean, they help with symptoms, so they may decrease your fever. They may help with that kind of thing, but there isn't an antiviral that treats the virus at its source.
And viruses are not bacteria. So,
correct.
So
antibiotics do not work.
Right.
Yes.
Antibiotics do not work. Don't bother. You're hurting yourself by asking for and taking an antibiotic for one.
Yep, and public health.
And public, right. And you
public
develop
health.
Resistance, and then you lose that antibiotic when you really
Which
need it.
Which we are close to losing anyway.
We are very close, yes.
So the only line of defense, it seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, you're the experts, would be vaccines, right? Ultimately?
Yes.
How long does it take to develop a vaccine? I got 20 seconds.
Okay, there's a team started out of the NIAID, Anthony Fauci's team. He wants something in clinical trials in 3 months, year before it hits the public, I think.
But that's a year down, at least a year down the road. In real time, probably 2 to 3.
By then it could mutate. We're here with Dr. Katie Passerotti from Atrium Health and Dr. Daniel Janis from UNC Charlotte. We're coming right back with more on this in a moment at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the new coronavirus that is slipping out of China and has caused a lot of deaths in China, a lot of infections in China. And this is just another example of a kind of an epidemic or pandemic. I'm going to ask for definitions for that in a second. that the media likes to talk about, because you need to be informed. But then people say, well, geez, how dangerous is this? How how much at risk am I? And we're here with Dr. Katie Pazzarotti, Medical Director of Infection Prevention at Atrium Health, and Dr. Daniel Janneys, with the Professor of Bioinformatics and Genomics at UNC Charlotte. Note from the producers. I'm going to give you the note from the producers, always important. We don't want to freak people out, they say. How worried should we really be about this coronavirus? Are we making too much out of this? Mountain out of a molehill.
I think we need to be aware of what's going on and be cautious with what we're doing to try to prevent spread. So I think some degree of awareness is important. I do think, you know, freaking people out does not accomplish anything and kind of works against you as far as controlling spread of infection. So realizing what the current state is in our area, that we have had no cases in North Carolina or in our immediate geographic region, and even within the United States, we've effectively been able to control the cases that have showed up. So we've had sporadic cases, but there's been no transmission within the United States, which is where we would start to worry a little bit more.
So we have these 7,700 infections, mm-hmm. and 170 deaths in China, and I think there are infections elsewhere. And in China, it seems to be the number of people infected seems to be increasing by about 1,000 to 1,500 a day. And the number is just climbing. I think it was 40-something last weekend, and here it is Thursday. It's up to 170 deaths. How does that compare to the flu?
So in our area, you know, we see about 35 to 50,000 cases of flu in a given year, many and deaths from that. So flu is much more of a concern in our immediate area than this novel coronavirus. And we're still very much at the height of flu season, where we can see, you know, protecting yourself against the flu is probably the most important thing you can do right now, rather than worrying about the coronavirus.
Because there have been deaths from the flu this year.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
You're a geneticist, mm-hmm. so there's a genetic component to these viruses, all viruses, and we have genes. So whether or not we get sick or how sick we get, does it depend on the genetic makeup of the virus in combination with our own genetic makeup?
Yeah, certainly there's susceptibility factors, probably not all well-described for coronavirus, but well-described for HIV, for example.
So does that mean that the future of treating these viruses may not be necessarily in vaccines, but in finding a way to genetically manipulate the virus itself or ourselves to create a defense against these viruses?
Yeah, certainly that would be an arm of, you know, personalized medicine, is you understand where your susceptibilities are.
Is that coming down the pike?
Yeah, it's already done for HIV. For example, the drug resistance profile of HIV has to be characterized for your particular infection. So okay. Your cocktail would be based on the variants of HIV you have.
Which is easier? Finding a virus, because you just said that takes about 3 months to develop and a year to test, and then it hits the market by that time.
That's the vaccine.
Yeah. The virus will probably have mutated, and that vaccine will not be as effective as perhaps it would have been could they have developed it last week. So is that the future, genetic manipulation, personalized medicine?
Well, I mean, there is, come full circle, we don't want to go around altering viruses, you know, wantonly. That would freak people out if we're not freaking people out. So there is a notion of, why do we have to reinvent the wheel every year for influenza? Well, it varies, right? Why do we have to reformulate the virus, or the vaccine, pardon me? One group, a few groups, are trying to look towards a universal vaccine that is directed against parts of the virus that are what are called evolutionary conserved year to year and have something more longstanding.
Mm-hmm. But is that necessarily the element in that virus that makes you sick?
No, but you just have to identify the virus and turn your immune system against it. Okay. You don't have to hit a certain part.
So as I said, this coronavirus has caused 170 deaths worldwide, over 7,700 cases of infection in China. It's growing at by 1,000 or 1,500 a day, which explains why the Chinese are trying to build 2,000-bed hospitals in a week. We're going to talk about that later. But for those suffering from this virus, what are the symptoms? How does it attack the body? What's going on?
So it presents very similarly to all types of cold and flu. So fevers, respiratory symptoms, cough, shortness of breath. In severe cases, you may have pneumonia or deeper lung infection that can be more severe. But the majority of people present very, very similarly to the common cold.
Are older people, younger people, certain people more susceptible to this than others?
So we're starting to learn a little bit about the virus and how it affects specific populations. So there's some data that 50 and older, and there might be a slight male predominance in the most recent kind of data that's coming out. But I will say we're very quickly learning about this virus, so I suspect some of that information will change over time. More severe infection does seem to be happening most in people with other medical conditions that make them predisposed to having worse outcomes than a healthy person.
Again, we don't have any cases of this in North Carolina or in our general Charlotte region. You haven't seen any cases. I don't know of any cases. But there are known cases of this virus in France, in South Korea, in Japan, in Nepal, Cambodia, Singapore, Vietnam, Taiwan, Canada, Sri Lanka, United Arab Emirates, and elsewhere in this country. Surely not all of the people infected visited that particular open-air market, one would think, nor did those people necessarily eat any infected animals. Is that an indication that this human-to-human transmission is strictly through the air?
I think it's most likely that all signs suggest that it is spread through the air, through droplets, so through when you cough and sneeze, respiratory particles kind of being spread through the air.
Does that make this virus then more dangerous than if you could only get it if you had eaten an infected or touched an infected animal?
For sure, because it increases the number of vectors for the disease, right? So it can spread much more easily when it's human to human than if you had to have direct contact with an animal to be infected.
So in an article this week in the Washington Post, it was stated that in rare cases, coronaviruses can spread from animals like camels and bats to humans. Household pets, however, they say, are not a threat. So two questions, Dr. Janet. Why are some viruses not transmissible between species? And why aren't household pets a threat if you have a virus that infects an animal that is then transmittable to humans?
Well, there certainly are lineages of coronaviruses that occur in household pets. There's dog coronavirus for sure. It's just not been demonstrated to be zoonotic, not gone from those dogs to their owners. You know? But that possibility is out there.
And that same article said that it's even rarer for these viruses, once spread from animals to human, to start to spread from human to human. So if it's so rare, how do you explain MERS and SARS and this coronavirus that's breaking out right now?
It's not rare.
The Washington
demonstrably
Post is
not rare. We're looking a lot harder now. But we have the tools to see it.
Right.
And it's the perfect storm, the right combination of factors that allow it to spread, right? We see limited transmission, but it may not have the ability to spread well from person to person. So, you know, you and me sitting in the same room potentially spread it, but maybe that stops there. You don't go to anyone else.
Yeah, there's spectacular stories, but SARS was only 8,400 cases.
We're already beyond
SARS. So it's kind
SARS.
Of rare, you know. In that measure. Yeah.
So it's not unusual to see people in China wearing face masks because the air is horrible because of the smog. And it's socially acceptable. In fact, it's probably encouraged to wear these face masks. But now people are wearing them not for the smog. They're wearing them so they don't get infected by this disease. Are any face masks that you can commercially buy at CVS going to prevent you from contracting a virus like this?
I would say nothing's 100%. Do they provide a barrier to the droplets getting into your mouth, to your mucous membranes? There's probably some benefit. Are they going to 100% protect you? No.
Because Colleen Kraft, Associate Chief Medical Officer for Emory University Hospital, says they aren't going to do any good.
They probably provide at least a little bit of protection. The masks that we use in healthcare are called N95, so they're ones that are fitted to your face, and they kind of close all the gaps that you see with the masks that people are wearing out in the kind of general public, so are more protective than surgical masks.
The World Health Organization has deemed this outbreak, and this is why we're talking about it, and this is why it spreads through the media, and this is why it's gotten all this attention. The World Health Organization calls this outbreak a global health emergency. red lights flashing, sirens going off. And they sent experts to China since the outbreak. And the United States has offered to send a team from the Centers for Disease Control. And Chinese authorities in that part of their country have closed schools until well into February, just to lessen the incidence of passing this on. Passengers arriving at airports, both departing passengers and arriving passengers in countries around the world from China, are being screened. Their temperatures being taken as they get off the airplane. American Airlines has become the latest domestic carrier to curtail flights to that country. I think there are four now. That I don't think any flights are going in or out of China. Is this an indication of just how serious this is, or precautions that have arisen because of previous experience of outbreaks of diseases like this? In other words, is this more than just standard operating procedure, or is it overkill?
For sure, it's more than standard operating procedure. I think people have been burned by past experience, so are wanting to control this on the front side before it gets too far out of the gate. You know, you're kind of darned if you do, darned if you don't. If you pull out all the stops and stop it before you get significant spread, people may kind of minimize that there could have been, you know, worldwide spread. We could have had a pandemic, but because of these measures, it was placed under control. If you let it go, then you're the bad guy because you didn't kind of stop it at the gate.
Yesterday, a local institution of higher education, they will go unnamed, sent an email to their people about this virus, outlining its symptoms and the caution that employees and students, quote, who have returned from China within the past 14 days and are sick with fever and a cough, or have difficulty breathing, should seek medical care immediately. I don't know if you can answer this question, but how out of the ordinary are emails of precaution like that sent to students, faculty, and staff?
I'm not currently in school, but it's very infrequent, I would imagine, that they say that to areas.
We got them. I was at Ohio State and during H1N1. We got them. We didn't get one for coronavirus, but I think We definitely got one on Friday at UNC Charlotte.
But I wasn't talking about you. I was talking about another institution.
Yeah, yeah. Ours was more moderate. Yeah.
Okay, so is it better to be safe than sorry? Do you want to err on the side of precaution? That's why these administrators send these out, or does that cause people just to become scared?
Well, I mean, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of care, right?
Okay.
Yeah. But you do have to be careful about buttonholing a certain population of people, because then you also may kind of raise fear for contact with certain populations. So I think there's a balance between making sure you're clear about who is at risk and who isn't at risk and what populations you're trying to be careful.
In the early 20th century, the world experienced a devastating outbreak of influenza. It killed a substantial number of people. The pandemic infected, I think, 500 million people around the world, one-third of the world's then population. It killed 20 to 50 million people, including 675,000 Americans. Why haven't we experienced, not that we want to, but why haven't we experienced more epidemics of that level of devastation? Is it something we've been doing or not doing, or have we just been lucky?
To some extent, we've just been lucky. I think most people in infectious disease think that we are at risk for having a large-scale pandemic. I think we have gotten better about controlling it, educating, putting control measures into place in hospitals, healthcare systems to prevent spread within those areas where people are congregating. But I think we are very much at risk, and it's, you know, it may happen in the not-too-distant future.
And we don't have any line of defense necessarily against that. Is that correct?
No, the best thing, again, is washing your hands, staying home. I sound like a broken record, and it sounds inadequate, but really the basics of preventing spread of infection, social distancing, washing your hands, that really is.
Well, let me ask you this then, because if we're washing our hands, but we've sneezed and the droplets from the sneezing get on countertops or other surfaces that we may not even be aware of, or even our clothes.
Right.
Because they'd say now cough into your elbow. Well, okay, well, that elbow area is going to be filled with bacteria or viral particles. How do we treat that?
You can't treat wherever they land, but washing your hands, you do, like you said, avoiding touching your face, washing your hands, and then not introducing. The virus gets in through mucous membranes, so by stopping that chain of transmission, you can stop infection.
But if I sneeze into my elbow, and those and I have this, whatever it is, whether it's the flu or this disease, and I sneeze into my elbow, and I'm walking around, and somebody touches my elbow, just come here for a second.
Well, viruses survive to different lengths of times on surfaces, so they're not indestructible once they're out of your body. They survive in human beings.
Are there products that we, if we do get sick with a flu or something like that, are there products that we should be spraying on our bathroom surfaces or our kitchen surfaces to make sure that we've eradicated all trace of that?
Luckily, this type of virus is susceptible to regular cleaning products. So Clorox wipes, Lysol wipes, those kind of things.
Just plain
just
soap
the function,
and water.
Soap and water, absolutely. But just the function of actually doing the cleaning is probably the most important part, more so than whatever product to use.
Okay. Why is soap and water effective? It just detaches the virus from the surface?
It breaks them up, yeah.
Okay.
And the friction of hand hygiene gets the viruses off your hand. That's probably the most important part of washing your hands.
So we keep hearing two words that are thrown out with regard to outbreaks like this. One is epidemic, the other is pandemic. Is there a difference?
Yes.
Okay.
Pandemic, yeah, let's go to that first because it's come up several times. And we have to be reminded, it's a very technical term of public health that doesn't speak to the severity of the virus, it speaks to its global spread. So pandemic means a virus or is moving around the world. That's it.
It's crossing borders.
Yes.
Okay. Epidemic is?
Epidemic, it means that there is a rapid increase in the number of cases in people.
And the National, not to put a damper on this conversation, but the National Academy of Medicine predicts future pandemics could kill millions and cost trillions of dollars. And some say it's just a matter of time. I alluded to that in the opening. The world is constantly being warned about these new diseases with the potential to wipe out humanity. And then they don't. Sometimes viruses present, they infect, they kill people, and then they just disappear. Why?
Healthcare. I mean, we didn't have vaccines. And, you know, the 1918 flu is a very severe strain of influenza. However, we didn't have vaccines. We didn't have good healthcare. We didn't even really know what it was. You know, so.
Is it difficult or is it easy for viruses to turn into pandemics?
Well, I think pandemic, again, is a geographic distinction. But look at 1918. We didn't have planes flying all over the place, but it got all over the world on almost every continent.
What role did World War I play in that, do you think?
Well, I mean, it's hard to repeat that experiment, but they say it was a lot of returning soldiers carrying it back to their home countries.
Yeah. I want to come back to this question of we're constantly being warned about these horrible, destructive diseases, and then it doesn't happen. I want to talk about that when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. Once the dust settles on the voting in Iowa and New Hampshire, the Democratic race for president heads south.
Make no doubt about it, the road to the White House starts in South Carolina.
The first in the South primary has been pivotal in picking Democratic nominees. Will that be the case this year? Join Charlotte Talks for a preview of the upcoming vote. We'll be at Winthrop University's DiGiorgio Campus Center Wednesday, February 12th at 7 p.m. Register to attend and find more information at wfae.org/charlottetalks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about this coronavirus and the outbreaks and transmission of viruses in general. They ought to call them viri, don't you think? Dr. Daniel Janis is with us. He's the Carol Grotnus Belk Distinguished Professor of Bioinformatics and Genomics at UNC Charlotte. Dr. Katie Passerotti is the Medical Director of Infection Prevention at Atrium Health. So we have these periodic scares of these new diseases or viruses that suddenly present and start killing thousands of people or infecting thousands of people, and you have the National Academy of Medicine telling us that future pandemics could kill millions of us, and it's only a matter of time. But then most of these viruses present, we have a panic, we talk about it in the media, and they go away, never to be heard of again. Or they are so low in their infection rate that it doesn't really matter anymore. Is this a case of the boy who cried wolf? Are we going to reach a stage where we are legitimately talking about this and people are going, eh? And then they get infected because they go, eh, it's not going to happen.
I mean, it does happen from time to time, but I'd push back a little bit on the fact that it happens regularly. We haven't had this degree of attention to a novel virus really since 2009 H1N1 in this country, and we haven't seen the rate of spread and the quickness of spread from the initial site of origin to other areas. A lot of those others were contained in just one or two kind of geographic regions, and we're seeing very quickly that not happening here. But to your point, does that make people think, oh, we're just talking about this again when we talk about ones that burn out quickly? It's possible. I would say that a lot of the reason they do burn out is because we pay attention to it, we put measures into place to prevent spread, and are able to kind of abort it early. So there's good parts and bad parts to that.
Every time a virus presents, it gives it a chance to mutate. Does that mean that every time it mutates, it's an opportunity for the virus to get stronger and more lethal, or could the opposite happen when it
mutates? Both happens, yeah. It's not intentional, so it's randomly mutating, it's poor in its replication. Some of those variants are going to be benign. Some of them are going to be more pathogenic. Some are not going to work at all.
Aside from the flu, are there any risk factors in the United States, in the developed world, that would cause a virus to suddenly present to the degree that this virus has presented in China and then suddenly begin to spread? Do we have factors in this country that could cause that to happen?
I would say everywhere is at risk for spread to happen. You know, the United States...
Or outbreak.
The United States isn't as set up for spread of outbreaks as areas with very high population density where there's even more social crowding and whatnot. So the United States, I wouldn't say, is at the top of the list for risk of outbreaks, but certainly there's plenty that goes on, and we could see spreads similar to other countries.
When an outbreak does occur, well, scientists immediately try to figure out where it started and who patient zero was and how they contacted. How do you do that? How do you find patient zero?
The traditional way is contact tracing. You ask everybody who's presented with the disease who they've seen in the last X weeks.
Yeah, you look for a commonality, and then you trace back to the first person with symptom onset, and that's, you know, ends up being your patient zero or your patient zeros that seem to be the initial source.
Put this in China, put this into perspective, because as I said, there's 7,700 confirmed cases of infection in China as of Thursday morning. Yesterday, there were 7,000. The day before, there were 5,000. It keeps growing exponentially, it seems. So put this into perspective in China. They're so serious about this that they're building a 1,000-bed hospital in a week and an additional 1,300-bed hospital within a 2-week period from the ground up. That's indicating that it's pretty dang serious.
Well, and you got to remember, in healthcare, it's not just the infected people, it's the worried well, it's all the people that have symptoms that wouldn't have otherwise sought healthcare that are going to be kind of crowding emergency rooms, crowding healthcare facilities. So beyond just the raw number of cases, you have to deal with all the others.
Would that be necessary here, or do we have enough hospitals and hospital beds to take care of an outbreak of this magnitude?
So hospitals in general tend to do pandemic planning. So what's your preparation when you have a huge surge of patients? How do you manage that? Do you put up tents? Do you, you know, how do we do that? So there's always the potential, because you don't want to build buildings and then have them lie empty and wasted, right? So part of the hospital's job is to try to figure out, okay, if this is happening, what's my contingency plan? How do I get the well people out quickly? How do I focus on the most? How do I use alternative methods of care, virtual visits, e-visits for people that don't need to be in kind of a healthcare setting? Our job is to try to plan ahead and figure out how to do that as much as possible.
You didn't answer my question. Oh, could we handle it?
Could we handle it with huge influxes of patients? It would be challenging.
Because we couldn't do what they're doing in China. We couldn't build a 1,000-bed hospital in a week because of regulations, which they don't have, and they're a top-down government. If they say build it, they build it. So we couldn't do that. If something were to break out in Charlotte like this, or if we were to become infected because of this outbreak to the degree that some people in China are experiencing, how confident are you we could handle it?
I feel fairly confident, but not 100% confident, I would say. It depends on the size of the outbreak. We could be at risk.
And are you doing anything right now to prepare for
Absolutely.
This?
I think hospitals across the country, and we've done that for, as we've talked about before, we are constantly at risk for the next pandemic. So there's always work in the background to figure out how to handle that influx of patients, no matter what.
China has restricted the movement and the lack of movement and the activities that 56 million people can take part in China. I don't think we could do that either. I don't think Americans would stand for it, would they?
I think there would be a lot more pushback on public health measures here, absolutely.
Yeah, I think you're correct.
But would that be stupid on our part not to cooperate with an order like that?
But we expect civil liberties. We don't quarantine. We have 50,000 people deaths a year from influenza, and we don't quarantine them.
They brought 200 Americans home from China yesterday in California, and they immediately flew them to a military base and put them in quarantine. And a health official was asked what options they have if somebody wants to leave. He said, well, they're free. Theoretically, they're free to leave, but we won't let them. So which is more important, public health or freedom of movement?
There is precedent for public health kind of putting in those containment. But people with tuberculosis that don't have safe home settings, things like that, public health can say you're a risk to the general public, so we have to contain it. Once it's in the broad population, there's not a ton of point to saying you have to stay in this restricted area because you've already kind of let the horse out of the gate.
If we had an epidemic of anything that required hospitalization and intense health care, and the quarantining of individuals, which means the feeding of individuals as well as health care, who pays for that in the United States of America, where we do not have universal health care? Who pays for that?
Good question.
We don't know. Public health officials don't know how you would pay for
thousands of people being hospitalized. No one has a budget for, hospitals absorb the cost of whatever the hospital care needs to be, but there's not a bucket of money kind of set aside for if we need to kind of feed these individuals in quarantine or whatnot, to my knowledge.
How should we feel about that? How do you feel about that? How do hospital administrators feel about that?
I mean, it's tricky, right? Because you put money away for an event that may or may not happen at whatever time. It's hard to predict when that's going to come into need.
Wow. Vaccines and antibiotics created a revolution in healthcare in the 20th century, and except for occasional outbreaks of particular diseases, usually in third world countries, we've been spared a lot of this. Have we been lulled into a false sense of security that we got this handled? Modern medicine can handle anything.
I think modern medicine can handle a lot. I think people are still cautious that bad things can still happen, even though modern medicine has advanced a significant way. And we may ultimately control it. Like we talked about, vaccine takes up to a year to 10 years in some circumstances to be developed. We have the ability to make those preventive measures that can stop the spread of infection, but it may take a while to put those into place.
Thanks to modern medicine, we live in a world where a lot of people today have never come into contact with a lot of diseases that killed their ancestors very quickly and widely. Modern vaccines have eradicated or all but eradicated diphtheria, some forms of influenza, hepatitis A and B, measles, mumps, pertussis, pneumococcal disease, polio, rubella, congenital rubella, smallpox, tetanus, and others. Could they come back if we stop taking these vaccines?
Measles was eradicated in the United States in 2000 and came back because people are avoiding the vaccination.
So are the vaccinations that you would give for an outbreak of virus like this, would they be considered by the anti-vaxxers in the same way that they considered measles vaccines and mumps vaccines?
I can't speak for what goes on in those communities, but the anti-vaccine people are very vehement about the amount of and frequency of delivery to children is one of their arguments.
The Ebola virus, and we talked about this, came to the United States a couple of years ago. I think a Liberian national brought it on a visit to the United States. He died, but others were infected. How did we contain that at the time? Do you remember?
Mm-hmm. So it's early identification of people that are at risk and then prompt isolation to prevent spread from other people. So those two measures are what have contained most infectious disease outbreaks over time.
I mean, there's still no cure for SARS, which is another one of these, what do we call them? Novel virus, coronaviruses. There's still no cure for SARS, but we were able to contain it. If you're successful at containment, does that just mean that the virus exhausts itself in the hosts it has already found and then just disappears? Is that what that means?
You stop the chain of transmission, right? So if you've been able to control it so that no one else can spread it, then that virus can no longer propagate.
But it's still there in the wild, wherever it came
potentially,
from.
Potentially, yeah,
no,
absolutely.
No, our work shows novel coronavirus out of Wuhan shares a recent common ancestor with SARS, and it's been hanging out in bats since SARS.
We know that bacteria are living organisms. We know that we are living organisms. What are viruses?
That's a good question. Do they hit all the marks for life? They require a host. Many parasites require a host that are descendant from animals that didn't require a host. So, yeah, I think they're living. On the other side of the coin is people say, well, they're just chemical reactions. But what's interesting about viruses is they've evolved multiple independent times. They're not descendant from one, you know, ancestral plant or animal.
So what is their genetic makeup? What are they?
All kinds of things. This is a coronavirus, and influenza are RNA-based viruses. There are DNA-based viruses as well, though.
And the difference is what?
The way their genome is encoded.
So if you have
which molecule
if
of
you,
the...
Does every organic, I mean, stones, rocks don't have genomes.
That is correct.
So only living things.
Correct.
So then they are living things.
That's a good definition, I would say, yeah.
Where are we with the containment of measles? Because we did have a resurgence of measles in certain populations and other, we've had it with mumps and other diseases that we considered to be eradicated. Where are we with that? Is it strictly dependent on people having their children vaccinated?
Most of the spread is rooted in anti-vaccine populations, so that is really where we've seen spread. And then there are certain people that can't get vaccinated, so when you have a population that's able to be vaccinated and is not, they can spread to those individuals with weak immune systems and what, and that's why we're seeing the increase in cases.
Has the medical community seen a decline in the number of people who are resistant to getting their children or having themselves vaccinated, or is it is the number staying steady?
No, unfortunately not. We're still seeing large populations, especially in certain areas that are anti-vaccine.
Okay.
And it's one of the big world health threats. Yeah. It's one of WHO's.
In its own right, yeah.
Yeah.
Martin on Facebook writes, why does it seem like these viruses start in Asia and Africa rather than North Carolina or Amsterdam, for that matter? It's a good question. Why?
Well, bear in mind, yeah, the conditions in Asia, the use of wildlife, food products, the crowding. Furthermore, though, think about H1N1. That emerged in North America, so it does
it can happen.
Yeah.
Dr. Pasarelli, Chinese health authorities quickly imposed a quarantine on the city of Wuhan, which is an enormous city, evidently, in terms of its population. They limited travel. They forbid people to leave. It's 11 million people. It's like half the size of New York. What would be our approach?
So if we had that degree of spread, I think there would be consideration of quarantine and isolation measures on a larger level than just individual populations. The public health department is working on kind of home isolation parameters if we do start to see cases to make sure people are staying out of the general public and preventing spread.
Is there any way that the Chinese or the people in Africa or even us can eradicate or prevent these sorts of outbreaks in the future? Anything we can do or not do that we're doing now or not doing now?
I mean, unfortunately, you know, we talked about the wet markets and whether that's kind of a source where infections can get into populations. We can always improve our basic, I hate to keep sounding like a broken record, but basic infection prevention practices, staying home when you're sick. Everyone wants to power through, go to work when you're ill, but that does cause spread, washing your hands.
In this country, we have seen outbreaks of stomach viruses, not viruses, but... in lettuce.
Due to
bacterial infection. And we pulled lettuce from the shelves.
Yeah.
Are the Chinese willing to pull these exotic animals from these wet markets? Could they do it?
They do it, but then they become lax or the trade goes underground. Yeah.
Is climate change playing any kind of role in the fact that we're seeing more diseases being spread that we never saw before?
There's a clear threat that vectors, let's say mosquitoes for sure, that's the last time I was here, mosquitoes that were previously restricted to the tropics that carry diseases like malaria or dengue virus, could extend their range throughout the continental United States.
I want to point out that there are stories all over the web about people looking up this virus in Google, and they're searching for Corona beer, Corona beer virus, because there's a beer called Corona, and this is a coronavirus. There is no association.
No association.
Dr. Katie Passerotti, Medical Director of Infection Prevention at Atrium Health, and Dr. Daniel Janis, Carol Grotnes-Belk, Distinguished Professor of Bioinformatics and Genomics at UNC Charlotte. Thank you both for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.